Hello, Jules Holland.
Hello, how lovely to be here, Jane. It's very nice to be with you today.
Well, very nice for you to be with us. Thank you so much. Esther and I were thinking about when we first came together and knew you.
It's sounding very biblical so far, if I may say so.
Yes, well, I've been watching The Crown, so I'm very much in that sort of mode. Not that that's biblical, but...
Excellent.
Well, I think I met you because I was on your radio show with Roland.
Yes.
Years and years and years ago, like in the early 90s.
I think that's right. I think Roland and I took you out to dinner and then we saw you in a couple of plays that were which were excellent.
Thank you. Well, like, yes, you took me to the Caprice.
And, yes, you gave you food poisoning as a treat.
Yeah, I had steak tartare and then had terrible stomach cramps and had to lie down on the floor in the Caprice.
Yes.
And, and then go to the loo and try and release my wind.
And Roland and I supported you by having sort of martinis and chatting.
Yes. I imagined that you were sort of like pressing on Jane's stomach, like, because I'm sure that she needs to release that wind. She's always trumping. She's a terrible trumper, Jules. I don't know whether you know that.
Both of our heads were gently laid upon her stomach, I think, for a little rest after our dinner. But we were concerned and called for her the next day. So it was I wouldn't want you to think we were some heartless brutes that were just sort of self-interested, scoffing
at
martinis.
You were very kind. You were wonderful.
Was there a large gas cloud over your... you lived in Islington then. Was there a large gas cloud in Islington?
I think there probably was. Over whole parts of London were swathed in a fog.
I've been in that fog, Jules.
Yes.
I'll tell you what.
It's a frightening place to be.
It really is.
Anyway, enough of that. So then Esther, we came together with Jules on Hunting Venus, and because you, Jules, brilliantly, wrote the theme tune with Nick Villiam.
We did some of the music. That's right. I think I got the job because I owned some keyboards that had been, it was set in the, it was like a night, it was an 80s pop group, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that's right, romantic. Yes.
And I had some of those keyboards left over from sort of the squeeze period, so I got the job because I had the right equipment. And so it was great fun. It's good, rather good film.
Do you remember the theme tune?
I'd be hard pressed to hum it now without sort of looking it up.
Can you sing it, Jane?
It was sometime on a trip to Uranus.
That's
Saturn,
right.
Pluto, Mars, who can blame us?
Yeah.
Only sometimes.
Yes.
Then
lots of innuendo.
Yeah, exactly. And normally, as Kenneth Williams always says, I mean, if I see a bit of innuendo in a song, I whip it out immediately.
That's very good.
Jules, yes. I've got, I then didn't meet you again until I came on the Hootenanny with the Paul Whitehouse when we did Nurse. And I just wanted to, I don't think you'll remember this because I know you must have a million guests of the Hootenanny in your mind, but I remember it so proudly because I did an impersonation of an animal into my pint glass, and I'm going to do it now. And I'm
it was a highlight of my new year. Please treat us to it again. It was really good. It's really good. I mean, it's one of the best chicken impersonations that we've ever had.
Actually, it wasn't a chicken. I'll give you one last guess. Hold on.
Is it a Bavarian warthog?
No, Jane, have you got any guesses?
Oh, a very rare type of grizzly bear.
No, it wasn't. It was a Sumatran tiger.
Ah, yes, that's what everybody wrote in to say. They were so delighted to hear that because they hadn't heard that sort of thing for some time on mainstream television, and it was great to have it back.
Jules, I've got some little questions for you to do with bees to get you in the mood. It's like a little mini quiz. Would you be up for it?
I would, and I mean, I should say that I'm a bit of a bee fan, and when I was first invited to on this program to be part of it, I was very excited because my main interest at that time was the use of bees in surveillance and espionage. But since then, I've been doing quite a bit of research, let me tell you, and I've found out quite a little bit more what the great, the mythology and the and previous uses and beliefs attached to bees. So I'm looking forward to sharing those with you. But I'm looking forward to your quiz now.
Okay, then. So I'll start with number one. Name the band from the Isle of Wight who take their name from bees.
Ah, Bee Bumble and the Stingers?
It's actually the Bees. That was easy one. Yeah,
let's see.
What about this one? Who had a hit in 1962 with the instrumental Nut Rocker?
Bee Bumble and the Stingers again.
Yay!
Yes. Yes.
Well done.
And yes. Number three. Name the Swedish garage rockers fronted by Howlin' Perla Alkmaarvist, can never say the name, who wrote the song Hate to Say I Told You So.
The Bees?
The Hives.
The Hives, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I confirm that, yeah.
And here we are. There's only two more left.
Yeah. The Honeycombs?
Yes, that's it.
Yes, the last one, hang on. Bumblebee Sting.
Yeah, that's it. And okay. The final one, who recorded a version of Honey Dripper by Joe Liggins in 1990?
Me.
Yay! Did that get you in the mood?
It certainly did. No doubt you've all got the multi-volume copy of The Golden Bough, the study of magic and religion by Sir James Frazer, written in the early part of the 20th century, where he's made a study of religions and cults around the world and reports his findings. But I did look in the index and found a couple of things which I thought were of interest. So, for instance, well, first of all, that the muses in Greek mythology had a great affinity with bees, and bees were associated with artists and poets because, of course, they were supposed to have put the honey on their lips, which would allow them to utter great poetry and song. There's a good old bee helping us out there.
And that's just regular honey, not like raw jelly or anything like that, just a regular bit of honey.
Exactly, and it's like it was a honey-type melody that would flow from their lips, much like the type you get, you know, in the squirty sort of packets, the squirty plastic things, which are quite a useful dispenser, I think, don't you? I mean, I know probably the purists don't go with that, but I think that's
how... No, we don't.
So if you could imagine being on a hot bath and having that honey squirted at you, that's what listening to a lovely song would be like after your lips had been tainted with, you know, no doubt Aretha Franklin just put a little bit of honey on her lips prior to singing a song.
And then she
Caruso.
Had a honeyed voice.
Precisely, exactly. But I don't know if they eat lots of honey or devour lots of honey or do smearings. I don't know. Anyway, I was blowing the dust off of a few great leather volumes here. And I also came up, I discovered on the volume of The Transmigration of Human Souls, which no doubt you've been reading over the last few days. Plato suggested, but although some people say he was only saying it as a sort of something to say rather than necessarily really believing it, that he held that the transmigration of human souls after death into the bodies of animals is a punishment or a degradation entailed by the soul's weakness. In other words, if you've been acting like a bit of a twat, then you're going to come back as a certain creature. And if you've been absolutely beyond reproach, then you sort of get to meet the gods, according to Plato. Anyway, so these are the examples he gave. So, the souls of gluttons, sots, and rakes would go into the bodies of asses. The souls of robbers and tyrants are born again into wolves and hawks. But the souls of, listen to this, sober, quiet people, untinctured by philosophy, I don't know if that means a bit dull and sort of stupid, I'm not quite sure, come to life as bees and ants. So there you go.
Wonder why. What do you think about that, then
they can learn something greater and they can be part of a wonderful workforce.
Good question. I'm not sure. I'll have to read the next volumes to actually report back fully on that. So, yes, in mythology, they work very well, the bee, you know. Also, I think the Egyptians have great big monuments to the ancients that are in the shapes of beehives.
Really?
Hmm. You weren't expecting that. I've surprised everybody, including
you
myself.
You are the historian.
Yeah,
exactly.
You are.
I'm the keeper of the bees' history. Yeah. Do you, out of interest, so do you both keep bees?
I'm a beekeeper, Jules, and I've been keeping bees for 12 years on my allotment up in Crouch End. Jane was interested in keeping bees at one point. So in this podcast, I've been trying to put her off keeping bees.
And she's been very successful so far.
Well, you mean once Jane realised that it was like very much like me, maybe Jane realised that it suddenly you didn't just turn up and see them a couple of times a year and they sort of thanked you and you went away again. There was a bit more sort of maintenance involved and everything.
Well, yes, and genocide.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you got bees then, Jules?
Well, only in my bonnet, so to speak. I do in our garden. There's sort of, you sometimes get a hive, but I, you know, as long as you leave them alone, they leave you alone. And I do like them. They say they're a messenger. I remember always being sort of rather frightened of bees until I was with the daughter of Clough Williams Ellis. Of course, Clough Williams Ellis being the architect who created Port Merion is a great architectural influence on me. Anyway, his daughter presented me with a plate after I opened a thing for them down there, and a huge bee came, and the gathered sort of dignitaries all sort of started sort of blubbering and running amok, you know, sort of running because of this one bee, big bee was there. And she said, "Stop, what's the matter with you? It's just simply a messenger from the gods." And everyone, "Oh, yes, of course, that's all right then." And after that, I realised there was nothing to be frightened of. You know, they were just, you know, would I be right in thinking of Esther?
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, the bees, for me, I always think they're a real sort of grounding element in my life, you know. So when they come to me or when I'm doing the beekeeping, I feel so in the moment and so present. And I think, you know, going back to when I did the Sumatran tiger impersonation, I think I was sort of thinking, well, bees have only got a tiny little buzz and a tiny little weeny voice, and they can't really, you know, they can't really shout for help in a way that a big Sumatran tiger can.
Yes.
But within their colony, presumably they can. Presumably they've not got a little quiet buzz within their colony.
Yes, is there a hierarchy, Esther? You know, like we know the queen bee's up the top there, but are there sort of generals, lieutenants, a middle management layer, so forth?
Yeah, there are. Well, I'm sure you already know that all the workers in the hive are female, but they all do have different jobs. So as soon as they're born, they come out and the first little job is polishing the cell that they came out of and getting it really clean, you know, with their mops and little brushes. And Jane would be very good at this job. They get the cell prepared for the next little egg to be laid. And then they move on through different little jobs. So then they become a nurse and they feed their little larva up to 1,000 times a day, you know. Ooh. keep giving it a bit of pollen and a bit of nectar and get it nice fattened up. And then after that, their next job is they start to produce wax and they start to build wax, and they produce these little tiny discs which they mould into wax. And then their final job is, before they go outside, is they become guards. So they guard the front of the hive. So that's the when they become a bit more tough, they're at the front of the hive checking who comes in and out. And then after that, that's about a 3-week process. And then after that, they become foragers.
So they're pretty busy. They do sound like they a little bit like the sober, quiet people untinctured by philosophy that were described to us. You know, they're not going out running amok, are they?
No. I mean, once they start going out collecting nectar, I bet they sort of do, because they go, you know, they go mad for it then. They're going mad for nectar, and then they come back and do a crazy waggle dance to show their sisters where to collect the forage. And they sometimes can get very excited by that. And if it's a super, super forage that they've found, they can almost waggle dance the other workers who are showing their waggle dance. They can waggle dance them off the comb, and with a strong pheromone, they can exude to sort of show that their forage is the best one, and everybody's got to go and find that.
Oh, I like the sound of that. But do they resent the fact, you think, that then after all of this tremendous hard work that they've been sort of doing with their sober, quiet ways, that then their wax is just smeared all over our furniture to make it a bit shiny, and then and their honey stuck in my coffee to make it a bit more agreeable? Do you think they're all right about that, or do they think, hold on, hold on a minute. We do all this, and then they scoff it. I mean, you know.
On a good year, bees do make too much of everything. So that's why the Apis mellifera, which is the European honeybee that we see, you know, they've got a massive colony. And so they do make excessive amounts of everything because they're so busy if the colony is strong. So I suppose that's why people have always taken the excess from them. But you know, so I don't think they're that miffed. But sometimes, well, they are miffed when you come and take the honey off. You know, they do go a bit mad, actually. And that's why the beekeeper has to, you know, obviously wear a net and get a bit of smoke to try and calm them down.
Did Jane have to wear one of those? Did you wear one of those, Jane, when you had looked at the bees at the allotment there? Did you have a great big sort of 2001 Space Odyssey suit on type of thing?
No, I decided to go naked.
Oh.
I thought, I'm going to go in there, brave, and see if the bees accept me. And and they did, didn't they, Esther? They just covered me and welcomed me.
They did get the stingers out, though, Jane, didn't they?
No, they didn't. They didn't get the stingers out. I wasn't stung in my private parts. You know, Esther has been stung a couple of times in her private regions.
But surely, is that, but I mean, without wishing to pry, is that because Esther was forgetting to wear her underpants?
I didn't have my steel underpants on that day. Mm. I should have had them on, but
beekeeper's pants, yes.
Didn't have them.
But in response, really, yes, I did wear a suit, Jules, and I've worn rather ad hoc footwear as well that Esther has created for me from bubble wrap.
Because you don't want them creeping up those little gaps. Just when you've got home and it's all over, there's suddenly a bee sort of flies out the bottom of your trousers.
Well, no, it was because I forgot my socks.
Oh.
I don't know whether I've ever asked you, Esther, when you were describing the different jobs that the bee goes through, the different rankings. When we did our candle making, I don't know whether I ever asked you, how do they make the wax?
They've got these little holes in their in their head region, not like ears, not like our wax comes out for our ears, but they've got these wax glands and the wax comes out of there like in these little discs, and then they mould it really, and they heat it up to a temperature, and they almost make these bubbles, these round little bubbles. But of course, when they all join up, they make the hexagon.
Oh.
So they don't come out as hexagons. Is that the right word? You know what? I'm dyslexic. So they don't come out as that. They come out as bubbles, and then they all join together in this big wax, you know, piece.
Just that's reminded me, of course, their hexagonal shape.
Yes, that's
which
it.
Which is how great that, I mean, it's quite, I mean, I don't know about these things. No doubt the phone lines will be jammed when I say this, but there's not so many things that are so geometric in nature as those hexagonal shapes that they come up with, are there? I mean, let's face it. It's like a 1970s brutalist bus garage or something like that that they've done all by themselves there.
I know.
They were doing them before, well before anybody thought of the brutalist bus garages or the lovely sort of David Hicks wallpaper from the 1970s that we all had, you know. But they were ahead of the game. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
you know, in the 18th century they would have looked at that, you know, and in the 12th century they would have looked at that.
Exactly, they've been going forever.
I mean, honey has a great. I mean, this is true. My great aunt, who was 104, used to have honey in her tea and coffee, and she attributed that to as being a big contributory factor to the fact she got to 104 and was sort of just living at home minding her own business.
Was that good, Jane, honey?
What do you want? She liked Manuka honey, but I don't, to be honest. I don't really like the taste of it. I prefer...
So it wasn't squeezy honey from a supermarket then?
No, but I do like the ones... If there's a local, you know, there's a local fellow that makes the honey, and I think that you don't get hay fever from local things if you have a local honey. But what, Jane, what do you use the honey for?
Well, I also put it in my tea, but it's a cheap version that I put in my tea because I feel that to put an expensive honey in tea would be wasteful. I wonder whether the boiling water reduces its potency. So, Esther?
Well, to be honest, Jane, no, I think, you know, if you use perhaps not so boiling water could be good, but actually you're cheating yourself there because, you know, there's so many different honeys that have got different properties. You know, some are good for calming you, some are good for, you know, antibacterial and all that sort of thing. So you're cheating yourself. If you can get these one flower, single flower honeys, like, you know, dandelion honey is very good for the liver, you know, like... heather honey, very full of antibacterial stuff. Calming honeys, let's think of a calming honey. Well, some of these Madagascan honeys that I've been tasting lately, you know, some of them have got very calming properties. And people use these single flower honeys for thousands of years. They've used them for different medicinal qualities. If they go on a particular flower, that comes through into the honey and gives you that property. So they're really, really good. So use the good ones. Use the good, like Jules's auntie, you know, I think she was right using that single flower Manuka honey.
Right, okay.
But, I mean, apart from consuming honey for general well-being, are there any way other sort of unusual things that we tips at where we can use honey? In other words, perhaps just a little bit of honey on the windscreen prevents it misting up, a little bit of honey on the arse crack means you don't have to have it waxed so often. Whatever,
I
don't know.
You can put them on wounds, can't you? You can put honey on wounds, can't you, Esther?
Yeah, that's it. But unusual things, like, you know, like you were just saying, you could put it perhaps, you know, on the doorbell to make it ring properly. But there was the famous case of Mick Jagger. He did. He was supposed to have gone to some sort of ritual where he put his stinger into some sort of bamboo thing, and it was full of honey and bees. And then he got stung, and it gave him the effect that he desired.
Oh well, there you are. Actually, I've got a showbiz story.
Yeah,
which Ronnie Wood told me.
Hmm.
Which is he went to a model railway shop with Rod Stewart. But they had a show that afternoon, but it was in New York City. And there was a sign on the window that said, outside the railway shop, any ladies, please knock before entering and alert. But not men, it just said, ladies, please. And he thought, what does that mean? And he didn't think anything of it. They went in. The man comes out from behind the counter and they said, oh, we've just come to see a couple of things in the shop. And then the man behind the counter just completely collapses. You know, and they thought, what's the matter with him? And it turned out that he was allergic to hairspray. And I think Ronnie was wearing a bit of hairspray. And so he just completely, that's what the sign was all about. But then another person came out from the back of the shop and said, we'll give him a little bit of coffee with honey and it will revive him.
And did it?
I think so, yes, for a few moments. For enough for him to make his peace with
everybody. So the caffeine, and the caffeine would kind of jolt him into awareness again, but what would the honey do?
I think it worked as an antidote to being allergic to hairspray. But I wouldn't recommend this to anybody who is allergic to hairspray to experiment, because I have no medical training or knowledge whatsoever. So if you are allergic to hairspray and you've heard this, don't then try spraying some hairspray with a cup of coffee and honey next to you, thinking, oh, that'll sort that out, because it might not. It might make things loads worse.
You You know what that reminded me of, Jules, is that once I was helping this guy put in install a beehive. He got some bees and they'd swarmed in his garden, so he put them in a hamper. And then so I went to try and get the bees out of the hamper and put them into a beehive. Anyway, we were sort of trying to brush the bees and shake them into the box and everything. And then I turn round, because we've been bending over for a long time. I turn round and the guy that I was trying to sort this job out for, I turn round and he had a big cluster of bees on his head, and it was like a beehive. It was a real beehive.
Was he aware of it?
No, he didn't know. So he had the suit on and everything, but because he was bending over, I think the queen must have crawled onto his head, and then all the bees must have followed onto his head, and it really literally made a beehive on his head. And I turned round and I saw this beehive on his head. I couldn't stop laughing. I think the queen's on your head, and all the bees have gathered on his head.
And what did he say? What was his response?
Well, he couldn't see it. Couldn't see that he had a full on beehive on his head.
Lovely.
Could have seen it, it was a joyous sight.
Quite frightening, I would have thought, as well, but nice to look at. A bit like sort of if you had head lice, but like much prettier. What about ornamental hives? You know, for instance, I think Louis XIV probably at Versailles had, I'm guessing now, but would have one made in the shape of a sort of a Chinese pavilion, you know, or maybe at Chatsworth in the 18th century, they'd have had one in the shape of a great big coronet or something. Are there any interesting, you know, modern hives that people have or interesting sort of ornamental things? Where do people stand on that?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, going back to Wolfgang Butterus, the artist, he actually caught a swarm and put it inside a cello. The bees lived in there. They filled it with wax and they lived happily for a whole season in that cello.
Did they make music?
They did put a recording into it and a little mini microphone. But actually, they lived in that. So bees will make a colony in anything that they feel is right for them.
I mean,
so
it's quite in a garden. It looks quite nice, and you've got the sort of green grass and a dark hedge and something, and then you have sort of the white painted hive of some ornamental design, or maybe a miniature brutalist bus garage, like we were saying earlier, or something like that.
Yeah,
you could have as a little trellick tower or something, you know, that they could all be in.
Would you consider having a hive, Jules, in your studio area?
If it was the right shape, yeah, I think it might be quite nice. You could have ones. Let me think what sort of shape you'd want. I mean, it would be. I did have, which was a bit of a disappointment, the ant farm. Which you got on the back of American Comics. And anyway, I did send off for somewhere, and it was in the advert, it appeared that you got a whole village where the ants, and with a sort of town hall and a jail and a theatre and restaurants and comfortable living facilities and everything, and the ants all lived there and wandered around, and then there was sort of sand underneath it. And in the advert, it looked like incredible. And I should have known that for sort of $4.98, it wasn't going to be maybe as much as I'd hoped. And what it in fact was, was a plastic, a see-through plastic, very thin sort of like little sort of, like it's a window pane really, with a silhouette, just a plastic silhouette in the shape of a little town with a town hall of it. And then sand below it and the ants burrowing around. And they didn't seem to have any regard for the buildings of doors, that they just seem to climb all over it. But it would be nice to have a thing for the bees, you know, where you had changing rooms for them, a little park area, maybe a little railway that would take them from one hive to the other.
But they're a bit like the bee, a bit like the ants. They just, what they do is they just cover everything in wax.
It was a very, very early on period of my life, that one of the only jobs I ever had that wasn't playing the piano, aged about 17, was being a salesman taking sort of things like Johnson Wax into supermarkets. When I was going into these supermarkets very briefly in the 1970s, I mean, you didn't have to do much to see. You just went in and sort of looked at the shelves, saw what was empty, and then went up to the supermarket manager and said, oh, you're a bit short of this, this and this, and then they'd sort of tick the box, and that was it, really. I just did it for 2 weeks. It's a temporary job. But one of the things I did, one of my sales gambits was, if a bloke wasn't really interested, I said, oh, we've got this new Johnson's wax here that you put on your furniture, and it's like actually Mr. Johnson's very best earwax, because at the time I didn't realise that it was bees that were doing it. I thought it was human wax. But they would buy it anyway.
Mr. Johnson had a lot of earwax.
Enormous amount. And that's how he'd done very well out of it, you know.
Became a millionaire from his own earwax.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, for instance, Harry Hill kept bees, and somebody said, "Is it for the honey?" And he said, "No, I'm keeping them because I want their pelts."
Oh, did he make a bee outfit, a bee coat out of it?
I think that's what he was hoping to do. Ultimately, it was going to take him some time, I think. Yeah.
Well, maybe he could have some little slippers or a hat.
Oh, that'd be lovely, wouldn't it?
It really would. I'd love that.
Yes, nobody has it. You'd think Lady Gaga would have done something with bees, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Maybe have little individual little gloves for each finger with a little bee glove to warm each finger.
Sounds lovely.
That does sound nice. I think that's another business we can go into, Jane.
That is surprising, actually, that nobody's done anything with their
fur. I think if anybody was to do it, it should be both of you. I can't think of anybody better.
Well, we had some fashion designers on not so long ago called Vin and Omi. We could have suggested that to them, couldn't we, Esther?
Well, I think I did say I'd send them some dead bees.
Oh.
Yeah, because they make clothes out of mushroom skins and chestnuts and things like that.
Mm.
When you're lying in the bracken in the morning, you could be wearing a little outfit like that, Jules, couldn't you?
Yes, just a little thong made of bee pelt.
Yes.
But it I would... only want ones that have died sort of naturally or humanely. I don't want them I don't want them slaughtered just for my purposes of vanity.
Well, in the summer they only live for 36 days, so you
can get quite... Is that right? I didn't know that. I thought it was for life, not just for the summer.
No. They've only got a few miles in them and then they're dead.
Oh.
And the ones in the winter sometimes perish, don't they, Esther, when they're on the outside of the hive.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the honeybees, they live for longer in the winter, for about 4 months. But with the ones on the outside, if it gets too cold, they might fall off. But going back to the bumblebees, the queen bumblebee, she hibernates in, you know, a little bit of soil or some loose leaves or something. So she does stay alive over the winter, the whole winter. And then sometimes you see them, don't you, on a cold day, you see them just coming out for a few minutes.
Up.
Yeah, all wrapped up in the bumblebee coat. Mm. And
scarf.
They can survive in the colder temperatures.
And should we be worried about these here Chinese giant hornets?
Oh, yes, we should. They are, well, in some countries in Europe, like Portugal and Spain, you know, they're seeing less wildflowers because the pollinators are all getting eaten up by these Asian hornets.
Oof.
So it is a worry, actually. We haven't had them on our allotment yet, but there's been a few cases in the UK.
Oh, dear.
So fingers crossed. Oh!
So that's my bee. It does look my pet bee. It barks.
Oh, thank you. That was so great.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, Jules.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. It's lovely to hear you.
So nice. We didn't have to do anything.
Lots of love. Very nice to hear you all both.
Lovely, Jules. Thank you.
Lots of love, Jane.
Lots of love to you, Jules. Good care.
Queen Bees is written and created by Esther Coles and Jane Horrocks. It is produced by Claire Broughton and Andy Goddard and partly recorded at the Hives on my allotment near Crouch End in London. Our title music is Sweet Nothing by Amy Mae Ellis and Will Cookson. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Queen Bees Pod for pictures and videos from the Hive. Queen Bees is a Hattrick podcast.